Okay, so we are starting the last section in truth. As I had said, we had actually done this first for a variety of reasons. It was a number of years ago. I think most of you were not here for that. Yisha, I think, was, so I apologize for the repetition. But a little chazara, especially of important ideas in Musar and Hashkafa, is probably not such a big problem. And this is the third book of Mishlei, and you can see that it's the beginning of a... Oh, I'm sorry, before I do that, I actually want to tell you one more thing about the end of Chaf Dalet, before we get to the new book. If you remember the last mashal in chapter 24 in Perek Chaf Dalet, this referred to a person saying, I walked by the field of a lazy person and a vineyard of a man, of an Adam, chaser lev, who did not have proper understanding. And I saw that field and I saw that vineyard, and behold, it was filled with kimshonim. Kimshonim are, the way the Gra learns, these are thorns, and charulim are poisonous weeds, like poison ivy, weeds that would burn or irritate your skin. And not only that, but the stone fence that was surrounding the vineyard and the field was in disrepair. And the lesson basically is that this is what laziness can do. Laziness can destroy a productive field, a productive vineyard, and make it into something very bad, right? That's what the pasuk says. So if you recall, the Vilna Gaon interprets that this is a mashal for a lack of industriousness in Limud HaTorah. And specifically, he made the point that a field, which is normally a field of grain from which you make bread, that refers to the portion of the Torah that's halacha. Whether it's, he doesn't mean Mishnah Berurah B'davka, but in other words, the part of learning that is focused on the practical ways that you have to follow Hashem's will. So that would include Mishnah, Gemara, in other words, any limud of halacha. But the karem, right, so that's the field, because we find that Torah is considered to be lechem, lechem. But the vineyard from which we produce grapes, and from grapes we produce wine, that is referring to the Agadah, or the sod of Torah, the Kabbalah. Now, he makes the point that with respect to the field, we talk about a person as lazy, because if a person works hard, they will understand halacha, right? That is the rule. That if a person says, Yagati, I worked hard, I toiled, v'lo matzasi, and I didn't understand the Torah, al tamin, we don't believe him, because for sure, if one works hard, one will understand the halacha. But with respect to the wine of Torah are the mysteries of Torah, the deeper insights of how God created the world, there are unfortunately no guarantees. The promise of Yagati Umatsasi Tamin and Yagati Volomatsasi Al Tamin does not apply to the sod. The sod, one has to, it's a gift from Hashem, and one has to have a heart that is discerning and able to understand. So as a result, you'll notice, the Grub points out, that the unsuccessful scholar of Halacha is described as Otzeil, lazy, on some level. Because if he wouldn't be lazy, on some level, he would understand. On the other hand, with respect to the Baal HaKerem, whose vineyard did not produce the wine, we don't describe him as lazy necessarily, but chaser leif, he lacks the emotional and intellectual acumen and heart and yiras Hashem, or whatever, the madrega of kedusha, whatever it would be, that would enable him to understand this. Therefore, he points out that is also the difference between kimshonim and charulim. Kimshonim means thorns, and charulim are weeds that will actually hurt you by passing by them. And he makes the difference that the kimshonim is referring to the sadeh, meaning to say that if I don't work hard to understand the Torah will be far from me. I'll be unable to approach it, meaning thorns keep you from moving forward. They don't actively hurt you unless you put your hand in it, but if I see thorns, I'm not going to move forward, I'm not going to connect to the Torah. Charulim, however, are weeds that actually hurt you. In fact, they can even hurt you from a distance a little bit, the vapors or the dust or something that can blow off them. And that's a reference to the idea that if one is not worthy or able to absorb the secrets of Kabbalah, and one tries to do so, it could actually be poisonous and injurious to them. And that is why, generally speaking, Gedolim over the generations have discouraged people to involve themselves in the Kabbalah unless they are 40, unless they're married, unless they have filled, right, the language of the standard Takana is they have filled their bellies with Shas and Poskim, because otherwise this could be very, very injurious to them.
Thorns are fairly obvious. You could see that there are thorns, and
right,
you stay away from them.
Right.
Poisonous weeds, unless you're an expert, a person
right
can get involved in poisonous weeds and before they know
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
So when that, you yeah, thought, if you see a weed, maybe it is poison, you keep away from it.
Yeah, you know, in this story, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's not apropos of anything, but it's connected to poisonous mushrooms, which reminds me of this. It's a wonderful story. You know, there was a great gadol, Rav Yisrael Gutzman, who was largely unknown to the general public because he was never involved in any type of politics, religious, or the like. He was just a Rosh Yeshiva
here in Israel.
Dr. Shlomo Zalman used to say he was so jealous of Gutzman because he did not have to be involved in all of the... No, Rechavia. Yeah. Now, Rav Gutzman had a whole interesting life before he came to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Gutzman married the daughter of one of the Dayanim on the Vilna Basin, and his father-in-law died very suddenly. So Rav Gutzman was appointed to be on the Vilna Beis Din when he was only 20 years old, which was absolutely, totally unheard of. Now, the Vilna Beis Din was headed by Rav Chaim Moser Grodzinski, who was the Gadol Hador, who was in his 70s at the time, and Rav Gutzman was 20. And all the Dayanim on the Vilna Beis Din were very, very great Gadol. They were much older than him, and they were already very great, established Gadolim. You may have heard of the Marcheshes, for example. I don't know, but Marcheshes was one of the Dayanim of Vilna. He was Rav Chaim Moser's right-hand man. In fact, Rav Chaim Moser often didn't decide many things in Vilna because he had the whole world to worry about. So the Marcheshes was kind of the one who ran Vilna. But Rav Gutzman was so almost embarrassed at being given this position that Rav Gutzman didn't like to paskin. Rav Gutzman would always, when people would ask him shilas, he would send them to the other Dayanim. So Rav Chaim Moser calls him in one day, and Rav Chaim Moser says, "Are you getting money? Are you getting a check from this based in every week?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "Well, you better start paskin it, you know, or you're stealing your salary." So so Rav Gutzman was very, very close to Rav Chaim Moser, and the story goes that he used to go to Rav Chaim Moser every day, and they would talk and learn. Remember, there were 50 years between them. And Chaim Moser was an unbelievable gadol. He was like mamish the gadol. And when I say the gadol, you have to understand what I mean by saying the gadol. When I say someone was the gadol ador, I don't just mean he was the most learned Torah scholar, although that was true also. But he took achrayas, he took responsibility for every physical and emotional and religious need that the Jewish people had. Remember, if Chaim Moser was the one who at the beginning of World War II, after the Nazi invasion of Poland, when he was dying of cancer, he was the one that engineered all of the visas to move the Mir Yeshiva, very complicated story, to move them out of Poland into Lithuania for the brief amount of time that Lithuania was independent, till it got absorbed by the Soviet Union, and that is how they were able to then get visas to America and the like. I mean, he orchestrated all of that. Dr. Chaim Moser was an amazing person in so many ways. My own Rosh Hashiva, Rav Ritterman, was a bacher, and he went to meet Rav Chaim Moser once. So he described Rav Chaim Moser, you know the way these chess grandmasters can play 30 games of chess at the same time? So he described Rav Chaim Moser, a table like this. There was a long table in his dining room, and there were like 20 people on either side of the table. And some Rabbanim were asking Shilas, and he was like answering like 5 Shilas at once. He was writing a tshuva while he was doing it. There were people who needed stucca. There were people who had other types of requests. His Rebbetzin was talking to somebody, and Chaim Moser would interject in that conversation. And when people would stop talking, and I think because they see him writing or something, he'd go, on, I hear you, you know, keep on going. And he was able to handle all of these things at the same time. One time, he had a gemach, he had 100 gemachs that he was managing. And one time, all of the financial records of the charity were lost, and he was just able to reconstruct all of the loans. A phenomenal person, but also in kindness, he was phenomenal. In fact, Vilna was not a totally religious city. We sometimes romanticize, you know, Europe. The truth is, the matter is, between the wars, especially after World War I, there was really a precipitous decline in the Frumkeit, especially in big cities. So most of Vilna was not necessarily that religious. And Rav Chaim Ozer, one called up like the head of the Jewish students at the University of Vilna. And these were not religious students, these were communists, actually. And he would call them in and say, you know, I know that you're not so religious, but I know that he gave them money for Pesach and Matzah. Like, he dealt with religious Jews, non-religious Jews. It was all the same. But anyway, so Rav Gutzman used to go to Rav Chaim Ozer every day, and they would talk and learning for a while. Rav Chaim Ozer needed to take walks for his health, so Rav Gutzman was his walking partner. So one time they're walking, instead of learning, Rav Chaim Ozer is pointing out grass and mushrooms and shrubs that human beings can eat, and how to distinguish between poisonous plants and non-poisonous. And he's giving a whole botany lesson. And Rav Gutzman is wondering, like, why on earth is he wasting our time with all of this discussion? Oh, you know, this is a mushroom. You eat this, you die within 5 minutes, but this one is good. And there seems to be, like, no reason for this conversation at all. Anyway, within the next year, the Nazis invaded Poland. And Chaim Ozer was already on his death, but he died shortly thereafter. But Rav Gutzman became a partisan, meaning he did not go to a concentration camp. He joined the partisans. Now, joining the partisans was not so safe either. The partisans were also very anti-Semitic, and they often killed Jews that joined them. But whatever it is, he survived as a partisan. And there were times that the only thing he and his wife could eat were the mushrooms and the plants. And he said that conversation with Rav Chaim Ozer saved his life. It was like Ruach HaKodesh. Rav Chaim Ozer had Ruach HaKodesh. Some other Rav Gutzman needed to know this information. So you're right, you got to be very careful about these mushrooms, right? Mushrooms, psychedelic mushrooms, poisonous mushrooms, all sorts of different types of mushrooms. All right, so that's how the Gra learns. The Gra learns that the Soda refers to the field of Halacha, which is called Lechem, and the Kerem refers to Kabbalah, the mystical parts of the Torah, the Agadata, the Midrashim, and their mystical meanings, which is called the wine. And for Halacha, if you don't know it well, it's laziness, because Yagatu Matzasa Tamid. For the Kabbalah, a person may lack the heart to understand it. It's not necessarily a function of their laziness. So I just wanted to share with you another pshat, which overlaps a little bit, but it's actually very different. This is a pshat from Rabbi Yoshua Heller, probably a name that you have not heard of, my guess is. But Rabbi Yoshua Heller was a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he wrote a few svarim al derech hamusar. He wrote a sefer, Chosein Yoshua. They all have Yoshua in the name, about Bittul Torah and the Eitzos, about how to be mechazik yourself for Torah. And he wrote a very beautiful perish on Pirkei Avos called Toldos Yoshua. By the way, for those of you that have very good bibliographical memories and perhaps have learned Maseches Oalos, he also wrote a commentary that's in the Big Mishnayos on several portions of Maseches Oalos that are very, very complicated. He didn't write on the whole Maseches, but he kind of helps you out in certain prakim. I think that's called Mayane Yehoshua. So it's very helpful if you're learning Perek Tes of Maseches Oalos in the regular, you know, Yachanu Boaz Mishnas. In fact, even the Kahati says that for Perek Tes of Oalos, which is an extremely difficult Perek, he writes, there are so many different Perushim, and every commentary gives a whole different shot and everything. He says he can't summarize everyone. That's impossible. So he picked Mayana Yehoshua, was the one that Kahati picked, to explain. So, so be it as it may, I just want to share with you. So indirectly, this is what you might call the base medrash of the Gra, because Rabbi Saul Salanter, his Rebbe was Rav Zundel of Salant, and Rav Zundel of Salant's Rebbe was Rav Chaim of Elazhen, and Rav Chaim of Elazhen's Rebbe was, of course, the Vilna Gaon. So this is the base midrashai shel Hagra, but it's a totally different pshat. And what Rabbi Shua Heller says, by the way, his brother was the Amudei Or, Rabbi Chiel Heller. Again, I'm not sure you've heard of it, but it was...
What country was it?
This is Lithuania. These are all Lithuanians, the Litvaks. But again, Lithuania, I shouldn't even say Lithuania, I should say Lita, because the boundaries of the Jewish country that's called Lita is part Russia, part Lithuania, part Poland. It doesn't correspond with Lithuania, per se. Like, what do they used to say? They used to say you have to look at the gefilte fish. It's the only way you can tell, because Polish gefilte fish is sweet, and Litvish gefilte fish is peppery. So the only way you know if this is Litvish or Polish, or is you have to look at the gefilte fish. It's the political boundaries change all the time, and they just didn't make a difference. So the Teldas Yeshua, Rav Yeshua Heller, goes on the second Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The second Mishnah in Pirkei Avos talks about the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. The Anshei Knesset HaGdola were a constitutive body of 120 elders, and these included the last prophets, the very last prophets, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, at the beginning of the Bayis Sheni, because prophecy is going to leave. And they are the ones, Ezra was the Miyaseit of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and they made many, many takanos for Klal Yisrael. They actually wrote the Siddur, so to speak, the Tfilos, and many, many takanos. So the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos records that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola had three primary teachings. You can call it their mission statement. What did they see that their mission statement was for Am Yisrael? So the first one was Havi Masunim Badin. Masunim, to be deliberate, to be patient in paskening halacha. Don't rush, take your time to be sure that you understand the halacha, and I would also add that you understand the metzias upon which the halacha is based, right? You can have a person who knows all the halachas, but if they're too much in a rush in terms of not understanding something, sometimes a person doesn't understand what he's being asked. He thinks he's being asked one thing and he'll answer, but he's really being asked a different question. So to be masun badin also means to be sure that the Rav understands the question as well, etc. That's number one. The second one was Hamidu Talmidim Harbe. Try to have as many Talmidim as you can, because you never really know which is going to be the one that will carry forth Torah to the new generation. And Bichlal, one should try to spread Torah in as wide a net as you can possibly do. That's their second message. And their third message is Asu Siyag La Torah, make a fence around the Torah, meaning this is the basis for many of the rabbinic enactments that started with the Anshei Knesset HaGdola and then continued, meaning even things that min haTorah are permitted, there is a makom to be strict. Don't do this, because if you get too close to the electric fence, you know, you might get a shock. Keep your distance. What do they say? In one of Dr. Abraham, Rabbi Abraham Twersky's books, he tells a story about, it's not such a nice story, but it's an interesting story. He says that the person owned a Svarim store, and a man comes in, and the man wants to buy the Siddur Otzer HaTfilos. Have you ever seen Otzer HaTfilos? It's a wonderful, wonderful Siddur. It's two volumes. And it's a Siddur. You get an Ashkenazi word Sfar, and it has many, many Meforshim on the Siddur. Very, very, very excellent. In fact, I see pictures of Rebbe Yashiv with bench Chanukah. He'd have his Otzer HaTfilos there. So it's two volumes. So the guy wanted to buy an Otzer HaTfilos. So the Meisher Sfarim knew that this person was not a learned person. So he says, you know, I'm happy to sell you an Otzer HaTfilos, but I don't think, are you able to read all of those different Meforshim and different commentaries? You know, maybe you want a regular Siddur. He He says, well, the truth is I don't read any of the commentaries. I just want a sinner, but I want it to be Yotzer Tfilas. So he says, why do you want an Yotzer Tfilas? So he says, well, you know, I have little kids at home. And the kids are pretty wild, and they're often ripping pages. They're ripping pages out of books and throwing them into the fire. So at least I know with the Yotzer Tfilas, you know, you have like 250 pages till you get to the beginning of the Siddur. There's a lot of introductions. So Mamela, I know that even if a lot of pages get thrown away, I'll still have my Siddur. Now, Rav Prisker wanted to say that on B'derech Mashal, that's kind of a mashal for a gezeira, meaning like this. If you make all sorts of harchakos, so even if people break the gezeira, they break it, you know, at least they haven't crossed the line yet, meaning it all depends where you draw the line. If the pshat is, this is the forbidden doraisa. If there be no gezeira, so people are going to go right up here, and then they're going to be nichshol. But if you make all sorts of fences, so even if they break the fences, at least they're not going to get to the, right? That's the swara of the idea of a gezeira, yeah.
How does that live with if you have a rabban and you have misa?
Yeah, it's true. But still, I mean, you know, they're going to be contradictions there. But lamaisa, we do paskin rabban, are more makel, I mean, on that. So anyway, so these are the three statements of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Hava Masunim Badin, Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, and Asu Siyag LaTorah. So the Tovish Hashua wants to say that second Mishnah is actually connected to the Mishnah before it. The Mishnah before it talks about Mesira Satira in three stages before we get to the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. First we say, Moshe got the Torah and gave it to Yoshua, right? So the first human transmission was Moshe to Yoshua. Then we have Yoshua to the Zekanim, the elders. Then the Zekanim to the Nevi'im, to the prophets. This was hundreds of years. And the prophets gave it to the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who were the last prophets. So we have three human transmission links. We have Moshe to Yoshua, number one, Yoshua to Zekanim, number two, Zekanim to Nevi'im, number three. The Tovah Yeshua wants to say that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, now that there's no longer going to be Nevi'im, are trying to take one idea from each of those transmissions. And he says the following. There are really three different components in Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebichsav is written, that's what it is. One component of Torah Shebal Peh are the laws, the halachos, that were directly given by Hashem to Moshe. Direct. There's no machlokas, there's no discussion, there is no human interaction, there are no svaras that we add. This was just said by Hashem to Moshe. The fact that tefillin are black and tefillin are square, in fact, a lot of these halachos taka are tefillin, right? This is not something we darshan, this is not something we derive. This is just what was said.
Did you practice at age 13?
That as well. That's correct. In fact, all shiurim, kazayas, all quantifications of halachas are halachal Moshe Mi-Sinai. That is what Moshe gave Yoshua. Right? Halachal Moshe Mi-Sinai. Right? That is halacha psuka. But you have to understand, and this is where sometimes well-meaning religious students are misunderstanding. You know, people say, for example, oh, every word of the Gemara, people say, I've heard this many times, every word of the Gemara was given by Hashem to Moshe, and it was handed down generation to generation till in the time of Rav Ashi, there was a risk that all of this would be forgotten, so it had to be written down. Now, let me ask you this. I don't want to introduce any heretical ideas into anybody's head. If I read a page of Gemara that a Rava asks Abaye a kasha, was it handed down to Abaye? Hey, Abaye, today you're going to ask Rava, or no, the other way around. Today, Rava, you're going to ask Abaye. I mean, it's very, very clear that Abaye and Rava are not reading from a script. They're not reading from a transcript. They're not reading from something that was handed down. It is a contemporaneous discussion. although infinitely greater than us, the same thing we're doing in a base medrash is what they're doing in a base medrash. Although, of course, the madrigas are totally not comparable in any way. So what do we mean when we say the oral law was handed by Moshe Mitzrayim? So we don't mean every single word of the Mishnah and Gemara was given to Moshe Mitzrayim. Of course, that's not the case. First of all, it can't be the case because a lot of it is Durabbanan later. But what it means is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe Rabbeinu klolim, general principles, and yesodos. They could be the Yud Gimel midos of interpretation, actually there are more midos of interpretation, but it was then left to the Chachamim in every generation to take the klolim that Hashem gave Moshe and figure out how to apply them to new situations. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not give Moshe the answer to every question. There are reasons for this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe the methodologies through which you could answer every question, but it was left to the Chachamim Shebechol Dor V'Dor, or at least the Sanhedrin, to apply. And that's why people ask the Kasha, how can there be machlokas? If Hashem gave an answer to every question, how can there be machlokas? Somebody got it wrong. And yet we do say, Elu v'Elu, Divrei Elokim Chayim, they're both right. The explanation is, the Rambam himself says, Hashem didn't give a specific answer to every question. Hashem basically said, these are the klalim, and this is what you have to do to figure out the answers. Now the Rambam says, two wise people, even with the same basic principles, can come out in different ways. That's machlokas. And when there's machlokas, Hashem says, as long as you're a legitimate chacham, and as long as there hasn't been a Sanhedrin that has definitively resolved it, whatever you say, it's like getting full credit for a process. As long as the process was followed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, that psak is considered to be emet. In fact, because of rules like Lo B'Shamayimi, the Torah is not in heaven, even if the chachamim get the answer wrong, it becomes the Ratzon Hashem. In other words, if you remember the Gemara in Bava Metzia, where Rabbi Eliezer was a minority view that the Chachamim disagreed with, and a voice from heaven, right, first Rabbi Eliezer did a lot of miracles, and a voice from heaven said, Rabbi Eliezer's right, and the Chachamim said, you keep out of it, Hashem. Lo b'shamayim hi. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, you're right, I'm going to keep out of it. It's a very, very amazing thing. Now why, and that's why it shayach so much machlokas. You know, they tell the story about Chavitz Chaim went to see Rav Chaim Soloveitchik once. Rav Chaim Brisker was a little older, and he was the Gadol Hador already. And Rav Chaim was davening Mincha, the Chavitz Chaim waited for him. And then, right after Rav Chaim finished Mincha, a man just bursts in. Sometimes a man just bursts in, kind of an uncouth guy. And the man just shouts out, Rebbe, how come there's so much machlokas in Torah? Why is there such a machlokas? So Rav Chaim, it's not Rav Chaim Eichel, it's Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim looks at the person and says, you're wrong. For every machlokas, there are many, many more things which there are common assumptions. For example, take a Mishnah in Sukkah, right? You have a Mishnah in Sukkah, right? Or let's say the first Mishnah in Brachas. The first Mishnah in Brachas gives you a machlokas, how late can you read the Shema of the night? Rabbi Eliezer says only the first, third, or fourth of the night, when people are still going to sleep. The Chachamim say until midnight. And Rabbi Gamliel says Amud HaShachar. So you have a machlokas, like the first two lines of the Mishnah is already a machlokas. But that's presupposing there's a mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. It's presupposing it's Doraisa in the morning at night. In other words, every machlokas, Rav Chaim says, presupposes, like a machlokas is the tip of the iceberg. There's all sorts of things in which there's common agreement. The first Mishnah of Sukkah. A sukkah that's above 20 amos, the Tanakhama says it's possible. Rav Yehuda's machshir. Machlokas right away! But how many common assumptions? That there is a sukkah, that there has to be sechach, etc. So Rav Chaim tells the person, he says, you're wrong. There's much more agreement than there is machlokas in Shas. Okay. So be it as it may, from Brisk to Radin is like a 6-hour train ride. So the Chafetz Chaim went back with his companion to Radin, and he's sitting quietly for 3 hours. And after 3 hours, he says to his companion, he says, Rav Chaim is really a gone, you know? Rav Chaim is a gone. So what's going on? What's going on is this. When a person kind of comes in and says, how come everything's a machlokas? So Rav Chaim immediately says, you're wrong. Very little is a machlokas. Most things are agreed upon. So he went to Wall of Shas in like 1 second, and he said that. The Chafetz Chaim wanted to test the proposition, so the Chafetz Chaim took a little longer. The Chafetz Chaim was chazering Shas for 3 hours, and he says, Rav Chaim is right. Rav Chaim is right, he's not going to go. They say, there was another maaseh to show you the Bekiyas about a gadol went to visit Rav Yosef Shaul Nachmanson, who was not a Lipshitz gadol, he was a Galicianer, a Polish gadol. And especially they were Mitzoyan with Bekiyas. In other words, in Lita, we sometimes think that they only emphasize learning in depth, although I just gave you a story about Bekiyas. But in Poland, Bekiyas was the outstanding characteristic. So imagine this little game to play. It was Lag Ba'Omer. So, what was it? So Rav Yosef Shaul Nachmanson said, I tell you what, let's go 33 Masechtas and Shas. And how many machloks and mabaya varava do you have? This is Lag Ba'Omer, 33rd day of the Omer. This is something we should do in honor of the day. So, without any smart, you know. So the man starts. The man was also a very chashuv talmid chacham, obviously, but he was younger, so he was the one that was doing it in brachas, and he's going through this stuff, and Rav Yosef Shaul Nachmanson is like falling asleep. He's just like dozing away. So he keeps on going. I mean, 33 Masechtos, he goes through Brachos, then Moed, then Noshim, then Nezikin. They're into Kodshim already. I mean, 33 Masechtos. So, Rav Yosef Shaul Nachmanson is falling asleep the whole time. Finally, Rav Yosef Nachmanson wakes up, and he says to him, very, very good. But you skip the machlekes and daf samach the beis and brachos and the burn the machlekes on. He went to Rabbi Masechta and he gave him a list of like the 20 places that the person left out. These were the games these gedolim used to play. These were the amusements, as it were, to be so shakua in Torah. But the point I want to make though is that although Rav Chaim's point is very emes, that we don't think about this because the Gemara itself focuses on the machlokas. But you know, even when you learn, you have, and part of learning is to understand, Taka, when you see a machlokas, what are the assumptions that everybody's masking to? That's sometimes a little bit of a work, because sometimes the assumptions that everybody's masking to are not articulate. And you need to figure it out. Maybe a machlokas we showed him, in fact. What are the common assumptions? But we cannot deny that there is still plenty of machlokas, right? Even with Rav Chaim's point. Now, why is there machlokas? Because once again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not machriya. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the yesodos out of which we're machriya, through pilpul, through swara, through analogy. And that is why the statement that every word in the Gemara comes from Hashem is certainly not true in a literal way. In fact, it's not even true about the Mishnah. Rav Yehuda, Rav Meir arguing, meaning it's based on the divine principles that Hashem gave to Moshe. But Hashem wanted the Chachamim to argue and come up with things. Now you might ask, and I mean, let me give you even a modern example. When electricity was not invented or harnessed in the 19th century, wasn't invented, it always existed, so immediately there's going to be a Shaila. There was a Shaila. Is electricity permitted on Shabbos? Is it called fire? So there were poskim who debated. I mean, now there's kind of a consensus, but there were poskim who debated electricity, fire, not fire, what is fire, etc. In those days, the only electric light was the incandescent light, and later things have to be redefined with fluorescent lights, with LED lights, you know, all sorts of issues like that. Okay. Now, when a posek is, let's say a posek is grappling, are you allowed to turn on electricity on Shabbos? Is the posek asking, in an ultimate sense, Did Hashem tell Moshe that electricity is usher? So I would suggest not. I would suggest that Hashem didn't say anything. Well, maybe Moshe privately, that could have been. But in terms of Bnei Yisrael, they were told nothing about electricity. Hashem said fire is usher, and it was left to the Chachamim, by analogy, by Svara, to try to figure out what is Nichlal and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Sibui. Same thing with every modern question. Whether it's surrogate motherhood, egg donation, nuclear war. Hashem didn't say specifically about that. He left it to the Chachamim to take the Yesodos of Torah Shebal Peh and apply it. Now you might say, and that's why it's Shaykh Machlokas. That's why Machlokas is not a stira to revelation. It would be a stira if revelation answered every question specifically. But if revelation does not answer every question specifically, it is yitachin to have machlekes. Now, you may ask, why did Hashem give the Torah in such a messy way? Hashem could have given the Torah, even Torah Shebal Peh, in which every answer, or every question, has an answer. No machlekes. Now, what are you going to say? Well, it wouldn't have made sense then. Well, Hashem is supposed to give tell Bnei Yisrael, don't use electricity. They don't know what electricity, I mean, you know, what would it even mean? No, all right, so Hashem could have told, could have given envelopes in stone, saying, don't open up before Tufshin, you know, Nun, or whatever it would be. And then we would see. The getter is, no, that part of Hashem's chavivas for Am Yisrael is he wants us to be creators with him of the truth of the Torah. He didn't want to give it to us in a silver platter. He wanted the inyan of pilpul, the inyan of svara, the inyan of working it out. That is a kinyan, that the Torah becomes our Torah. Ad kidei kach, that lo b'shamayim, that he's not even supposed to help us out in that process. He helps us out with siyata nishmaya spiritually, but he cannot give us the answer. HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot give us the answer. That's what Lo B'Shamayim means. If he tells you this is the answer, we don't listen to it. Quite amazing. Now, a mashal, you may have heard this mashal before, because I've used it before. I've used the mashal of making a cake. You know, let's say you have a 4-year-old child, and you want to make a cake for her. For her, for him, whoever it is. So the easiest way of making the cake is when the child is asleep or in the gun, you make a cake. So good, you, your wife, whatever it is. So it's easy. Nice cake. But a deeper way of showing love is you make the cake with the child. You invite the child to make the cake with you. Now, if you make a cake with a 4-year-old, the cake will actually objectively not be as good. Number one, the kitchen will be a mess. There'll be sugar on the counter and chocolate on the floor and pieces of eggshell, and the cake may be lumpy, overbaked at one end and underbaked in the other end. You could certainly do a much better job when they're asleep, just take care of it. But the love is not in the quality of the final product. The love is in the relationship of sharing in that final product. Torah is really exactly the same thing. A Torah that would have totally been the product of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, totally, with no human input of the Chachamim, would have been a neater Torah, less messy. There would be fewer ambiguities, fewer confusions, fewer machlokas, fewer uncertainty. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to make the cake with Am Yisrael. That is why Rav Yitzchak Yochanan writes that is why we talk about Torah as Matan Torah, not just meaning God gave us the Torah, but God gave away the Torah. God gave the Torah to us in the sense that he says we become creators of the Torah itself. So that's the inyan of pilpul. That's why pilpul, I don't mean pilpul in the negative sense, we sometimes use it as kvetching, I don't mean that, but the pilpul of the Torah is the analysis, figuring it out, drawing analogies. Like, what does the Gemara do? The Gemara is medame. It compares one thing to another, it differentiates one thing to another. It tries to look at a precedent, and then it says it's not that's not a precedent. Or it takes analogies and from you know, very far-flung areas. A din in Shabbos might be relevant to what's a rishus for gittin, etc. All of this is the union of pilpul of Torah. So this is a great matana that Hashem gave us, that we have a shaychus in the Yetzirah of Torah. So Memela, going back to what told us Yoshua, Moshe to Yoshua represents the halacha l'Moshe Misinai of halachas psukais. The zakenim already represent the union of pilpul and analogy and medame milsa l'milsa. That's the kayach of pilpul. Even drushas are that way. When the chachamim make a drusha, they are creating a new halacha that was not known until that drusha. It's not a halacha l'Moshe Misinai. A drasha is the kayach of the chachamim to look into the Torah and infer a new interpretation. Now, so Moshe to Yoshua is halacha psuka. Yoshua to Zakenim is the notion of pilpul, which is the ikar of Torah Shebal Peh. Now, the third level is Nevi'im. What role do Nevi'im have in Torah Shebal Peh? So, at one level, they have very little role. A Navi cannot be machriya halacha. Number one, a Navi cannot go against halacha. If a Navi tells you that from now on, Shabbos is to be observed on Sunday, he's a Navi Sheker, even if he does all the miracles in the world. But number two, even if he's not going against halacha, but if he's simply telling you who to paskin like, that is a chisorin of lo b'shamayim. Right? There are exceptions for haras shah, temporary suspensions like Eliyahu on Mount Carmel, built an altar outside of the Mikdash. That's called haras shah. But other than that, a Navi has no koach. That may be a different rule, but this is the Loba Shemayimi, and it sometimes goes by a rule, Ein HaNavi Rishoy L'Chadesh Dovar Me'ata. Now, one thing, just a little ha'ara, though, that's interesting. If you may remember the beginning of Maseches Brachos, where Rav Yossi says, one time he went into a churba, he went into an abandoned building, a ruin, and Eliyahu HaNavi told him that you're not allowed to go into a churba. There are three reasons why you don't go into a churba. One is because of chashad; people will suspect that you have an immoral thing you're doing there. And one is mazikin; there were demons that frequented abandoned buildings. And the third is mapolas; the building might collapse, and the like. And if you remember, the Gemara in Brachos gives different siyurim where one chashash will apply and not the other chashash. So, for example, if two people go, you know, there's no mazikin, okay, whatever it would be. But the Achrayim ask Akasha, how can we learn Ave Halacha from Eliyahu HaNavi? Eliyahu HaNavi is a Navi, that's Loba Shemayim. So the Maariv Tzchiya says like this, Eliyahu Tzchiya says, Mechalek, between paskining a halacha and being megala a metzias. If you think about this, it's the following. There already is a halacha that you're not allowed to put yourself in sakana, and there is a halacha that you're not allowed to do something that causes people to think you're doing aveiros. Eliyahu HaNavi did not create that halacha. He's simply informing me that in abandoned buildings, these concerns exist.
Reminding us.
Yeah, in other words, if a Navi were to tell me that this street is a dangerous street, don't go on the street because there are terrorists today, that wouldn't be a chisard of Loba Shemayimi. He's simply being Megala Metzias. So you have to go through a halacha of Mishum Gimel Devarim Ein Nechtasim B'Chorba is not actually a new halacha. It is simply telling me a metzias that in a chorba there is chashad, there is mapolas, there is mazikah. By informing me of that metzias, memela the halacha says I can't go in because that's a pre-existing halacha. So the Maariv Tzchiya says that Loba Shemayimi only applies to halachos, it does not apply to a metzias. So l'chari, you might say, so what is the role of a Navi? So he says, the primary role of a Navi is to be a spiritual leader of Am Yisrael, in the sense of inspiring us in Yiras Shamayim and giving us Musar and Tochacha, so we shouldn't violate the Torah. He doesn't make halachos, but he is the Baal Musar. He's like the Mashgiach, so to speak. So these are the three Shalavim in the components of the Torah Sheval Peh. There is the halacha L'moshe Misinai, which is fixed. There is the Kayach of Pilpul. And there is the spiritual ruchnius of the Navi that is designed to inspire us to keep the Torah and to warn us of the consequences if we don't keep the Torah, even though the Navi's directives are not concretized in terms of halachos per se. So the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who are speaking to a time when there will not be a Sanhedrin, when there will not be Nevi'im anymore, are addressing each of these three components. This is what they say. Havi masunim badin, be deliberate in judgment. That refers to the idea that be conscientious in holding on to the halachas that are psukais. In other words, the definitive halachas, whether they be halacha l'moshe Misinai, whether they be the beferish halachas in Shulchan Aruch, you need to be a masun, you need to take your time, you need to chazer it a lot, you need to go over it again and again and again, so you shouldn't forget the halachas. That is masunin badin. Hemidu talmidim harbe is the assurance of the kayach of pilpul, because the more people you have learning, the more different svaris are going to be said, the deeper the analysis is going to be. If it would be just a question of remembering existing halachos, I don't need a lot of people for that. Meaning, if I have my Shulchan Aruch and I learn it. But if it's to apply it to new situations where you need pilpul and chiddush and creativity, the more people you have, the better. So therefore, hamidu talmidim harbe is keneged the role of the zakenim. And the third one is, what is the role of the Nevi'im that inspired us with Yiras Shamayim to be marchik from Averos? That would be replaced by the Gezerah, which is putting a fence around the Torah. So therefore he wants to point out that that Yehoshua, Zakenim, Nevi'im, corresponds in turn to Mesunim Badin, Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, and Asu Siyav Latera. See, very nice how he connects the first two Mishnayos. Yeah.
Going just back one step in terms of Machlokas, it's the Rambam of Perish the Mishkabadarab, the Rambam of Perish Mishnayos, who may also be quoting from Uktzik, says there's a very good reason why we're writing everything down and showing the Machlokas, is because in the future someone may come up with an idea and they'll say, this is the right way to follow. We show that that idea was suggested and right. It was rejected. And all those beautiful things, we know what not to do because right. they already dealt with it way back there with the Tanaim and Amarayim, so we know. So that's an advantage. So sometimes even when a person would write a sefer, sometimes he comes up with a spora that sounds very logical, but it's not applicable. I do that with, we'll talk about it now, but then you say, this is the thought, but it's unacceptable according to Rav Aaron Cutler or Moshe Feinstein, because of their principles that they had, you can't apply it. So you put something in that looks like it's good, but it's really not good. That's what the Rambam says, called the following books.
Yeah, this is the Mishnah in Edges. But in fact, the Mishnah in Edges is another thing as well. It really gives two reasons. It says, but the Mishnah Nedjus does ask Akasha, why does the Mishnah preserve minority views? As the Mishnah says, the Chachamim say this, and one individual rabbi says this.
Like
we don't paskin like the individual. So why does the Mishnah bother to record a view that we don't paskin like? So the Mishnah actually gives two reasons. One reason is, it is a safeguard that if somebody later says, how can you say that halacha is like this majority? I have an unbroken tradition that halacha is so and so. So if we would just have forgotten about that view, we wouldn't know how to refute him, as you said. Now we can say, yes, indeed, there was such a tradition, but we trace it to a yachid. In other words, by keeping the basis of what we don't paskin like, that is a way we could refute somebody who tries to bring it up. That's one reason. But then the Mishnah gives another reason. It says, by preserving a minority view, if a later Sanhedrin, not us, if a later Sanhedrin would want to paskin differently, they wouldn't have been able to do so unless they could find an earlier view that at least was a minority shita. Now that's a shver mishnah actually, because mimanefshach. If the later Sanhedrin is greater in wisdom, they could do it anyway. And if they're not greater in wisdom, they can't do it anyway. In other words, the Mishnah seems to be introducing a new principle that they could be mevato an earlier Sanhedrin if there was a minority of that earlier Sanhedrin that held that way. The question is, you don't find such a cloud, but it's a question how to learn the Mishnah. But that's what the Mishnah says. So it turns out that preserving minority opinions is not only to discredit them, but it might be a way of giving them value if a later Sanhedrin decides it wants to revive them. I mean, Lahavdil, this is actually in the, let's say, the Supreme Court, the United States, but in Israel as well. So there are 9 members, right? So they decide cases, it could be 5-4. So you often have dissenting opinions. You have opinions written by the people who didn't vote with the majority. Now, what's the tachlis? What happens often is they're writing because when the Supreme Court changes, it's not like halacha, which hopefully remains stable. There, conservative, liberal, whatever it is. When the members of the court change, everything can get overthrown, so they can go back to that dissent, and that becomes the majority. That becomes the majority opinion. They want to put their position in that a later judge could read it. So, but Lahavdil, the Mishnah in Edges is actually making a similar point regarding those minority views.
The conservative movement, they have standards, halachic standards, and rabbis, certain group of rabbis are together, and there's a minority opinion, and then anyone can follow the minority opinion. In other words, you have 9 rabbis saying one thing, and one rabbi says, and he's very meiko. Now we can rely upon it because it's a minority.
Well, this is why, Rav Chaim Leiser had a cheshbon. Going back to Rav Chaim Leiser, Rav Chaim Leiser didn't want to paskin on certain matters because here's what he said. This is very, very, it's a funny reasoning, but it really holds true. When they asked him about it, is electricity mutter on Shabbos? And he said, it's usher. And they said, well, could you write a tshuva on it? He says, no, I'm not going to write a tshuva on it. So he says, why? Because if I write a tshuva on it, and I say it's usher, people are going to say, well, Rav Chaim Leiser had to write 10 pages that it's usher, so. So obviously, it's a shayla. even if you write 10 pages that it's usher, people are going to say, yeah, no. There must be some reason that really it's mutter. This is the way people think. So sometimes just writing a psak of Isser will give people the idea that it's a debatable issue. So he didn't want to write. Okay. I mean, that's kind of why, although many people say it's a chisarin, it's kind of why, and a lot of contemporary issues sometimes that the Pais can really hold a usher, they don't write shuvas that it's usher.
He could have written vadai usher.
I say the internet, smartphone, whatever it is. Nobody writes any shuvas on these things. But part of it is because they tell you, once you start writing a tshuva, that's going to mean, really it's mutter. People think that way.
The subject is open for debate.
It's open for debate, right. Okay, so now why am I bringing this in? This was a long digression, longer than I thought it would be. But in a long footnote, Rav Heller then goes on and says, maybe this is the meaning. These 3 things are merumas in the pasuk, al sada ish otzeh lavarti. Now this is different than the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon learned, if you remember, that sada is a field of grain, which is lechem, and that's halacha. And the kerem is the vineyard of wine, and that's Kabbalah. Here he learns differently. He learns that the word sada does not have to mean a field of grain, but rather sada is any unplanted shetach of land that you can plant. So he says, Sada and Kerem are the same thing. Meaning, Sada is the vineyard before it's planted, and Kerem is the vineyard after it's planted. In other words, it's one thing. And he says the following. He says, Sada is the raw material Hashem gave you. Hashem gave you the ground. That corresponds to the halacha l'moshe misinai. Hashem gave you that. Kerem is what you produce by your work on what Hashem gave you. So kerem represents the koach of pilvul.
Then there's the wall.
And then the wall is the siyag l'torah. So he says that sada ish otzel avarti, that refers to the laziness of not being masun badin. Kerem adam chaser leiv is a lack of the koach of pilvul. And Gather Avonav Nerasa is when people ignore the Siyagim, right? He says that's the remez of the Korban. Now again, I mean, his pshat does not answer everything. It doesn't answer why does it say Chasr Leiv instead of Vassal. I mean, in other words, the Gras pshat answered certain diyukim. It just doesn't answer, but he wanted to read this into this these psukim as well. Now I think he also goes with Kimshainim and Charulim. I'm trying to, that I don't remember. That the Kula Kimshainim, I'm going to have to check that Nakuda. Okay, but I just wanted to share with you that that Ha'ara from the Toldos Sheshu. Again, a very, very excellent sefer. Okay, so now we'll start Perek Chafei. Again, Perek Chafei is Mishlei Part 3, because it actually begins with a new beginning. Gam Eila, these two, the following. Our Mishle Shlomo are the proverbs of Shlomo. Asher hatiku anshe Chizkia melech Yehuda. So this is actually very, very interesting. Remember, Chizkia is a very righteous king. This is the famous Chizkiyahu melech Yehuda. He was a righteous king, although his son was very bad, Menashe. Remember the Gemara in Brachos that Chizkiyahu did not want to get married, because Chizkiyahu saw with Ruach HaKodesh that he would have a son that would be a Rasha, and because of this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made him very ill, and he was going to die. And the Navi Yeshayahu went to him and said, "You're Chayav Misa, because you are not Mekayim, the mitzvah of Pru Urvu." And he said, "Well, I don't want to do that mitzvah, because I'm going to have a son that is a Rasha." And Yeshayahu told him, "Bahade kavshe derachamana lamalach. Why are you occupying yourself with the secrets of Hashem? What happens to your children is Hashem's business. You must do your mitzvah." Now again, just to be sure people understand the historical epic, you do understand that Chizkiyahu HaMelech was king at a time when the Assyrian Empire of Sancheriv had toppled the 10 tribes. And after Sancheriv had toppled the 10 tribes, Sancheriv then turned towards Yerushalayim. And it was not just... So two things are happening at the same time, really. Chizkiyahu himself is on his deathbed, but also the Jewish nation and the Beis HaMikdash itself is very, very vulnerable and almost on the verge of destruction. It was one of the miracles that happened Pesach night, that 180,000 of Sancheriv's army died miraculously Pesach night. That is one of the miracles that is even mentioned. It's not mentioned in the Haggadah, obviously, but it's mentioned in the songs at the end of Haggadah. It actually talks about the Mapala of Sancheriv Pesach night. Now, be it as it may, though. So what did Yeshayahu tell him? Again, the story is an important story. So Yeshayahu said, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you my daughter to marry. Maybe perhaps that would change the decree." And Chizkiyahu married Yeshayahu's daughter. And he did have a son, Menashe, who became a great, 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 great Rasha. And in fact, according to Chazal, it's not Beferish, Menashe actually killed his grandfather, Yeshayahu. Menashe killed Yeshayahu HaNavi eventually. Yeshayahu keeps on giving Musar and Musar and Musar. He got him killed. Now, people ask the Kasha generally, I mean, what's going on here? We sometimes talk about, are kids born bad? Is there a denial of Bechira here? Is it the Pshat that, you know, there's a Nevuah that a child is going to be born in Russia? Menashe didn't have the Bechira to be a righteous person. How could that be? Can such a thing be? So really, the Mefarshim explained that nothing is inevitable here. Menashe was born with very, very strong tendencies to do certain averas. But those tendencies could have been arrested. They could have been channeled. They could have been changed. Meaning, when Hashem gives you a strong netiyah l'ra, He also gives you a strong koach to be miskaber over the ra. Because otherwise, bechira is not possible. So the question becomes, why couldn't Menashe be miskaber? So, what's fascinating is, this might be an example of a self-fulfilling prophecy, psychologically. And that is, now why Hashem gave Chizkiyo the nevuah, that's, I don't have an answer for. But here is the point. If your child is born and you are convinced that it is inevitable, he will be a Rasha, then how are you mechanech the child? What do you do with such a child? Right? It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. He who thinks his kid is bad is going to have a bad kid. I'm simplifying it a little bit, but that's the way it is. Right? If you think your child will be a tzaddik, then you know you can help him be a tzaddik. If you think he's a Rasha, he'll become a Rasha. So, why Chizkiyahu was given this information, I don't know, but it could have been ultimately a self-defeating prophecy. But I want to tell you one interesting thing, one amazing thing. This is also, now that I remember, this is not in the same place, but this is another word from the Talmud Yeshua. Again, I wasn't even thinking of this, but it comes out here. And that is, you know, we have two different historical accounts of the kings of the Jews. We have the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, and we have the Sefer Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles. Divrei Hayamim is a very, very hard Sefer, because Miman Efshach, it either repeats what we already know, so you have Akasha, why repeat? Or it contradicts what we already know, in which case you have a kasha. In other words, everything about Divrei Hayamim is shver. Because it either says the same thing or it contradicts. So Miman Efshach, you have a kasha.
Does it add anything new?
It adds as well. Yeah, but sometimes an addition may be a contradiction. Yeah. So one of the outstanding contradictions, or additions, depending on how you call it, between Divrei Hayamim and Malachim is how it treats Menashe. It's very, very fascinating. In the Sefer Malachim, you read Malachim, and that's what most people, if they learn Nach at all, they will probably learn Malachim more than Divrei Hayamim. So it talks about Menashe as a Rasha. Menashe became king at 12 years old, and he ruled for 55 years. He ruled a very long time. And he was Shakua in Avodah Zorah, Gilui Arayah, Shvichas Damim. He was not only Chayte, but he was Machti as Harabim. And in fact, the Psukim say it was during Menashe's reign that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Geishin, there would be a Chorban, even though there were some kings after Menashe, nonetheless. So Menashe is irredeemable. Mushkas. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Ein lo chelik le'olam haba. Alright, that's fine. That's how most of us view Menashe. But then, you look at Divrei Hayamim, there's a whole other story there. He says Menashe was a real bad guy and did all these sins and was machshel people and the chaytei machli as a rabbin. But then he says he was taken prisoner by Bavel, and in his imprisonment he returned to Hashem b'chol levavo v'chol nafsho, and he eventually was restored somehow to his malchus, and he ended his malchus as a righteous, good person. Mamish, Stira Nifla. According to Divrei Hayamim, Menashe did tshuva. In the book of Malachim, Menashe didn't do tshuva. What is it? Now you can call that an addition, but it seems to be a contradiction. Because in Malachim it says Menashe died, you know, it describes him as a Rasha, and it says he died. That implies he died as a Rasha. So the Talmud Yeshua wants to say like this. Talmud Yeshua wants to say that part of the nafgamina in the biographies between Malachim and Divrei Hayamim is Malachim describes the person as a king, and Divrei Hayamim is describing the person, as an individual. So he says, in Menashe, and this is true for all of us in a smaller way, there are two elements of his rishus. There is the fact that he was a chayte, he himself was a sinner. But then there was the issue, because he was a king, he was machti as a rabbim, he was mashrish in Klal Yisrael, a ruach of tumah, a ruach of chet. Now the problem is, When I do tshuva for my chatoim, that's a wonderful thing. But how have I repaired the damage I did to the fabric of the nation, being mashrish chatoim? So Memela, the book of Malachim, which is looking at Menashe's accomplishments as a melech, says he died as a Rasha because the Chilul Hashem that he created in the nation was not eradicated by his tshuva. As an individual taka, that's Divrei HaYomim, he did tshuva b'chol levavoy b'chol nafshei. So l'gabi his chatoim, Hashem forgave him. And so that's the scary thing about Chilul Hashem. When a person is mechalel Shem Shemayim, and he causes other people to despise the Torah, he causes other people to leave the Torah, so very good. I do tshuva, but how does that fix everybody else, right? So that's how we found first the difference between Divrei HaYomim and the book of a book of Malachim.
That's why the Rambam says Hilchos Tshuva, Nisa is the only kapara for Chilul Hashem. A person wants to do all sorts of things,
right,
but not have a kapara except that's how bad Chilul Hashem is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now Rabbeinu Yaina does say, Rabbeinu Yaina is chaylik on the Rambam. Rabbeinu Yaina says that even Chilul Hashem could have tshuva by very, very devoted limud haTorah, because that's called death. Zayt zatayya adam ki yamas biaya. And he says you could have a kapara by trying to sanctify Hashem's name to the same degree that you desecrate it. Right. Now the Rambam probably did not accept that, because the Rambam said you may not be affecting the same people. If I turned off this group, so I haven't undone that by turning on that group. Because I don't look at the whole total, I have to look at the individual people that I turned off. Right, but Rabbeinu Yaina seems to look at it more in an aggregate, way. Okay.
How did the Yom Chasen Yeshua understand the Mishnah that he doesn't have a chelik in Olam Haba?
He seems to say that because he was Machti Yisarabim, he doesn't have a chelik. Now what is his tikkun? What about the fact that he himself did tshuva?
Yeah.
So there may be Gilgulim, there may be other ideas that would give Menashe a tikkun and the like. Meaning, mitzad the life that he led, because that damage was not undone, he could not go to Olam Haba for that. But Hashem would give him multiple chances to come back again, and the like.
Maybe Emo Chelik L'Olam Haba, but because of his tshuva, he doesn't go to Gehenna.
So he's in limbo. Well, okay, that's not so pleasant.
The Ma'amar has brings that he's like in charge of seven levels of Gan Eden, and he says he's in charge of like the fifth one or the fourth one, which is where Baal Tshuva is. That's the Ma'amar that brings that.
I'd like to look at that, because even though the Lashon is Ein Lo Chelik L'Olam Haba, but he still says.
I heard that there was a Yeshua he does have.
I'm gonna look in Sanhedrin, but the Stam Mishnah says he does not have a chelik in Olam Haba. But be this as it may, we were talking about Menashe, but here it doesn't say Menashe. We're going back to Chizkiah. Chizkiah himself, or Chizkiyo, as he's often called, you know, all these names, Yirmiyo, anything that ends with a Yud Hey, which is Hashem's name, normally in Tanakh has the extra vav, so it shouldn't end with Hashem's name there. Now, Chizkiyahu was many years after Shlomo. Chizkiyahu is, of course, a direct descendant, son after Ben Acher, Ben Acher, Ben. But this is around 150 years after. So this is very interesting. So you actually have an explicit testimony that this part of the book of Mishle was not put into this book until 150 years after Shlomo's death. Sometimes you hear these ideas and you think, oh, these are modern, you know, Bible scholars, and you know, here it says Beferish, that this was copied down. Apparently what happened was this. Shlomo HaMelech had many, many, many Mishalim. In fact, it says in the book of Malachim, he had 3,000 Mishalim, which is more than we have in the book of Mishle. So a decision has to be made by people who can make such a decision. What is considered to be Ruach HaKodesh that we include in Kisvei HaKodesh? And what are words of wisdom, but they don't have the Kedusha, that would be included in Kisvei HaKodesh? In other words, a choice had to be made from a lot of material. And some of the material, again, I'm sure everything Shlomo HaMelech said was worthwhile. But there's worthwhile, and then there's words of Kedusha. So at the time of Chizkiyahu, a decision was made. We're not exactly told who these are. Anshei Chizkiyahu. Is it the Sanhedrin? Is it other Chachamim? You know, we don't know for sure. But a decision was made to be matik, to copy from larger materials what was considered to be Ruach HaKodesh. Now, you know that this was a debate, we're not told that there's any debate here, we're only given the final decision. But you know, in the Mishnah itself, there are debates among Tanoim, much later, Tanoim after the Churban, whether certain Svarim are included in Tanakh, Kisvei HaKodesh. Remember the Mishnah in Yadayim. Now the way the Mishnah discusses it in a way that's in a way counterintuitive at first. It discusses which books are Mitame the Yadayim. Now, if I were to ask you, make your hands tame. Is Tumas Yadayim mean a book has Kedusha or doesn't have Kedusha? You know, the gut reaction would be, Mitame Yadayim means it's bad. Not Mitame Yadayim means it's good. Opposite. Tumas Yadayim means it's good, and if it's not Mitame Yadayim, it means it's either bad or neutral. But what's the pshat? Chazal made a gezeira that if you touch, and I'll discuss the Chayyadim says how does it apply today, but let's talk about the original designer. If you touch a scroll of Torah, Nevi'im, or Kesuvim, a scroll, we'll talk about a printed sefer in a moment, your hands are tamei, and you are not allowed to eat truma until you wash your hands. Not just bread, you couldn't eat an apple of truma until you wash your hands. It's mitamei yasiyadayim, and by the same token, if a piece of truma comes into contact with a scroll of Torah, Nevi'im, or Ksuvim, that piece of truma is tamei and it must be burnt. Now, why did they make such a takana? So the Gemara in Shabbos says they made such a takana because people used to store their truma with Kisvei HaKodesh, because they would say Kisvei HaKodesh are holy and truma is holy. So I'll keep my grain of truma with my Sefer Torahs. They're both Kadosh. Problem is, of course, that when the mice come in to eat the grain, they'll also gnaw at the Sefer Torah. So Chazal wanted to create a certain takana to keep the holy writings away from truma, and they did so by creating a tuma on the Kisvei HaKodesh. Now, they're not mitame me totally. If I touch, I don't become tame. My hands become tame and truma becomes tame. So if it touches the truma got to be burnt. If it touches my hands, nishtefelech, I have to wash my hands before I eat a truma. So consequently, a regular sefer or a regular book, in fact, this is the Mishnah even says in Yadayim that the tztukim used to make fun of the Purushim. The tztukim don't believe in the oral law. The tztukim would say, what type of sense do your rules make? He says, a sefer Torah makes truma tame, and smatame mayadayim, sifrei homiris. Who is homiris? Homer, in all probability. The books of Homer, nothing's wrong with that. Meaning, it's not matame. What do you mean? Your Torah is less holy than Homer? But it's the other way around. According to the Kedusha, is the tuma. Now, in that sugi in Masechus Yadayim, which talks about the special rabbinic tuma of the hands, there are certain debates whether certain svarim are considered kadosh to be matame yadayim. Meaning, there were some chachamim that said it is not kisvei HaKodesh. And the three svarim that are debated, there are different combinations among the Amrim. One is Megillas Esther. There is an opinion that says Megillas Esther is not Kisvei HaKodesh. It's not Mitame Yadayim. Now, be sure you understand what that means. That doesn't mean that the one that said it's not Mitame Yadayim didn't read the Megillah on Purim. There is a chiyuv to read the Megillah on Purim. But he learned The same way there's a chiyuv to daven mincha, there's a, in other words, it's not haba atalia. You can have a chiyuv to read the Megillah on Purim, to remember the historical event of Purim, to be makir tov to Hashem, but that doesn't mean you have to take the position that the Book of Esther was written under a special divine inspiration. In other words, he would look at it like a historical chronicle that Chazal obligated me to read. In other words, they're not arguing about the chiyuv of reading Megillah. They're just arguing whether Esther is part of Tanakh. Now, we, of course, posit it is. But all I'm saying is, these were late debates. These were debates in Yavne. These were debates after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. That they were still debating, do we include it or not? The other book was Shira Shira, which some thought, now this is even, I think, even more extreme. Some thought it was not even a holy book at all, because it was love poetry. And it was only Rabbi Akiva that said, Shira Shira is Kodesh, Kodesh, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is 100, is 50 years after the Churban. Right, so, and the other is Kohelis. There were also discussions about Yechezkel, because there are things in the Navi Yechezkel that are connected to Torah, and it mentions that a certain Tana locked himself in an attic to fend for all of the steerists, etc., and only when he had an answer to the steerists, right? So there were canonization debates, meaning to say there were debates among Chazal which books make it. And that's why we have a whole category called Svarim Chitzonim. You know, you've heard the phrase the Apocrypha. Apocrypha are hidden books. The Book of the Maccabees, the story of Hanukkah. The Rishonim consider the Sefer Maccabim to be a reliable source of history. Rashi, in a few places, quotes from it. So it's perfectly fine. It's not apikorsis, but it doesn't have the status of Kedusha. It has the status of history. Which means, maybe it's wrong, maybe it's right. Meaning it's not 100, in other words, it doesn't have Kedusha. But it's still considered to be a valid historical book. The Book of Ben Sira, which is a book very much like Mishlei, but Chazal decided it did not have the Kiddush, right? So a decision had to be made, and this part of Mishlei is Mishalim, that the Anshei Chizkiyah Melech Yehuda were Ma'atik, they copied from, I guess, larger collections. Now, what's interesting, do we have the rest of the stuff? Right? So that's an interesting question. So it is interesting that one of the Svarim Chitzainim we have is called Chachmas Shlomo, Sefer Chachmas Shlomo. I don't mean the Marshal. There's a Sefer, an apocryphal book. And the Ramban even brings the Sefer Chachmas Shlomo in the Hakdama to the Torah. He quotes a long quotation from the Chachmas Shlomo. So some say the Chachmas Shlomo were other Mishalim of Shlomo, that did not have a din of Ruach HaKodesh. Others say that Bechlal, it's apocryphal, meaning he didn't write that book at all. In other words, it's not a work of Shlomo that doesn't have Kedusha, rather it's not even a work of Shlomo. So that's, you know, we don't even know what those things are. Okay.
The Chayyadim?
Oh, yeah. So the halacha is very interesting, because the Chayyadim discusses this issue. The Chayyadim discusses Chayra, if there's Tumas Yadayim, So what if I touch a sefer? I mean, people learn. I touch a sefer during a meal. Do I have to bread meal? Do I have to wash my hands? Because remember, without getting into all the takanas, whenever you would have to wash for truma, you have to wash for bread, even if it's not truma. So, if it would be metame my hands that I couldn't eat truma, then for bread I'd have to wash. So. If I touch a sefer during a meal, do I have to wash my hands again? So here the Chayyadim says, and all Paiskim say, that this din of Kisvei HaKadosh Metamei Siyadayim is only for Sfarim that are written in Ksav HaShuas, in ink, and in a scroll. It does not apply to printed Sfarim at all. But the Chayyadim does have a Chumrah, and he says, if you touch your tefillin during a meal, including the Ritzuas, that has a din of Kisvei HaKodesh, and it's Metamin Esayadayim. Now, this is important because you are allowed, although it's not our minhag so much, although I see some bachurim beginning to do it, you are allowed to eat in tefillin, although I would not encourage you to do it. You can wear tefillin while you eat, as long as you're not masiyach das from tefillin. But the Chayyadim says, now the question is, I'm trying to understand it. If I wear my tefillin while I'm eating, and let's say I have the ritzuas on my fingers, so l'chayra, according to the Chayyadim, it would be impossible for me to eat the bread.
No, you wrap it up.
That's what I'm saying. So
you have your fingers free, you wrap it around your
That's correct. Right, that's correct. So if you're going to wear tefillin, again, I'm not encouraging anyone to do this, but if you're going to wear tefillin when you eat, so just like you'd have to, obviously, wrap it up to do Netilas Shadayim in the first place, you would not then rewrap the Ritzuas. Because the Chayyadim says, if your fingers or your hand touches the Ritzuas, that's Nichlal, even Bizman Hazeh, in Kisvei HaKodesh, Mitamin Asiyadayim.
Why is it just in Bizman Hazeh?
Why is it what?
Why is it Bizman Hazeh?
Well, he says that all the kind of supply. If I touch a sefer Torah, bismanas. In other words, the law of the Mishnah says if you touch either kisvei hakodesh in a scroll, or the cases or the ritzuas of a scroll, a mezuzah would be the same thing, according to Chayyadim. Not even the Chayyadim. I think according to everybody, if I were to touch now, not the case of a mezuzah, that's not the problem. But if I touch a mezuzah in the middle of a meal, a scroll of mezuzah. I'd have to wash my hands. That's the din of Tumas Yadayim. Because remember, Netilas Yadayim for bread is based on Netilas Yadayim for Truma. So if you'd have to wash for Truma, you'd have to wash for bread. Now, not everybody, by the way, some people are chelik. Some people say, this is a different lumbus, some people say that Kisvei HaKodesh is a unique Truma law. In other words, the Tumah of Kisvei HaKodesh, even in the time of the Mishnah, only applied to Truma, it did not apply to Chulin. Meaning, if I'm eating non-Truma bread, I could even touch a Torah, and others, none of those laws apply. Meaning, the correlation of Truma and Chulin is only for Tumah, like a Sheretz or something like that. It does not apply to the unique Tumah of Kisvei HaKodesh. But the Chayyadim disagrees, and therefore the Chayyadim says it wouldn't apply to a printed sefer, but it would apply to tefillin, ritzuas, mezuzah, sefer Torah, and the like, even bisman
itself. According to the verses, you do need to wash for bread. You'd wash again with a bracha?
No. Well, look, according to Chayyadim, you would, but we don't make a bracha precisely because it's a suffix. But the Chayyadim would say you make a bracha. The Chayyadim says, you are mechuyev in the Tilas Yadayim, me'ikir hadin, so you make a bracha again. That's great. But Lamaisa, we don't, precisely because of that. So, this might be a good example of altihi tzadik harve, right? The Pasuk says in Kehelet, don't be too much of a tzadik. A person wants to be a tzadik, I want to wear my tefillin. It's like, well, you should not. You know, a lot of things can happen where bedavka, you know, you're eating bread without mitzvah shadayim. That's a very big avera. If you're wearing your tefillin in the wrong way, you put it over your hands.
What about
and
drinking a cup of coffee? That also you shouldn't do?
With what? With
tefillin on, you have a cup of coffee.
No, you're allowed to do it. That you're allowed to do. In other words, the concern we were saying is that for bread, it would make your hands tummy for bread. Yeah, if it's not for bread, unless your coffee is truma, but you know, it's not. Today it's not going to be truma. So
bread or cake? Would cake also be for the same because of the grain?
Well, I mean, if you're not eating enough cake to have to wash, again, I mean,
it has to do with washing.
It has to do with washing. So whatever, I mean, that itself is a complicated question. How much cake
basically
do you have?
Bread,
to? In other words, it's totally on the Netilas Yadayim. That if you're mechuyev in Netilas Yadayim, this is matamei my Yadayim, and I have to do Netilas Yadayim. Anything I'm eating that doesn't need Netilas Yadayim, so Tumas Yadayim is not. It's not relevant. Okay. All right. Let's just do one pasuk here. And this is again a very very significant pasuk. The pasuk says, "Kavod Elokim Hasher Davar, Kavod Melachim Chakor Davar." It is the glory of God for matters to be concealed. It is the glory of kings for matters to be exposed. Now the simple meaning, although this is not completely how the Gra will learn it, is that it is drawing a contrast between a flesh and blood ruler and the Melech Malchei Amlachim. Flesh and blood rulers, although they have many secrets they don't want to expose, but when it comes to their kavod, their glory, their wealth, their power, they want more and more people to know about it. They want the world to know how great they are, how powerful they are. Right? Kings are glorified when they publicize their conquests and their accomplishments. But the glory of Hashem is enhanced when things are kept secret. Meaning to say, this refers to the sodos of the Torah, Kabbalah, because when a person truly has Yiras Hashem, he understands that I really can't understand what's going on. And if I attempt to publicize it, I attempt to explain it, then I'm implying that it is within my grasp. And that itself, remember, remember the Gemara in Brachos about a person who got up, he was davening for the Amud, and he had many, many praises for Hashem. Akel, God, I kept on going. And he was told, have you finished praising HaKadosh Baruch? Because, you know, you said 20 things, is that all you're going to say? Elamai, we say three things, Hakel, HaGadol, HaGibor, VaHanayim. And David HaMelech said, L'cha Dumiya Sehila, to you, silence is the greatest praise. Silence is the greatest praise. I keep on going. The implication is, I've said all that I can about Hashem, but that's not Shaykh. So I keep it low-key, because by definition, what's the use? So Memela, it turns out, in the area of the mysteries of the Torah, we keep it concealed, because there's no way we'll really understand. Hashem is glorified by the Hester, by the concealment, because as if we're saying, we have such reverence for this that we know we don't understand it. Now, the Gra says a little differently. The first part of the Pasuk, he learns largely the same. That it is the glory of Hashem for there to be concealment. But then he says, Kavod Malachim, instead of saying Malachim are flesh and blood kings, he goes with the approach that Malachim refers to Talmidei Chachamim. And people who are learning Halacha. And that is, when it comes to the mysteries of God's creation, we keep it silent. But when it comes to uncovering the halachos and how to apply it, they're fakert, chakor davor, we continue to investigate in all the different, in all of the different ways. In other words, fakert, that we try to understand the meaning of a halacha, how to apply the halacha, and that is a glory to Hashem that we're mefalpel in it.
What was the first category that we don't try to understand it?
Again, that's the same. That refers to the secrets of creation, how God created the world, and the mysteries of how Hashem interacts with the world. What we would call sodos and Kabbalah. And that's kind of the concept of haster tavor, of keeping it concealed. Because in our attempt to understand it, there's a certain gaiva and arrogance that we're implying that we're able to understand it. So the greatest glory to Hashem is when you keep it mechusa.
Would that include cosmology? Ashmanavars, they want to know how the world began. Would we be allowed to read those books?
Well, to the degree that they are describing physical processes, assuming it's not against the Torah's belief generally, that will be okay, because, you know, physical processes are physical processes. But to understand the spiritual realities, there's a certain hester. That is why Agadata is written in a mysterious, enigmatic way. Midrashim are written in hints. Kabbalah is written in hints. Because it is not kavod to expose ideas that people don't understand and give them the impression that they do understand it. Because that cheapens the idea. That makes it sound like it's no big deal. And that's not a kavod Hashem. The kavod Hashem is that people should be makir, that this is beyond their madrega. Okay, maybe we'll stop here.
I haven't written down somewhere, but this is more like called a hook. Quote.
Yeah.
So,
Well, it's a construct. Kavod Elokim is the honor of. Kavod is just kavod shell. No, kavod shell. Kavod